This is a takeaway for Friday, March 2nd, 2018.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and here's President Trump just last week.
Well, Jared's done an outstanding job. I think he's been treated very unfairly. He's a high-quality person. He works for nothing, just so, you know, nobody ever reports that, but he gets zero.
Jared Kushner is President Trump's senior advisor and his son-in-law. He doesn't take a government salary, but whether he works for nothing, as the president says, has become another question. Up until a little more than a year ago, Jared Kushner was the public face of the Kushner Companies, the family real estate business.
Jared is truly outstanding. He was very successful when he was in the private sector. He's working on peace in the Middle East and some other small and very easy deals.
Jared Kushner stepped down from his official role at the family business, the Kushner Companies, when he joined the White House. But he hasn't completely cut ties with his family's real estate projects. And that's caught the attention of federal prosecutors in New York, state regulators, and special counsel Robert Mueller. Andrea Bernstein is senior editor for politics and policy for WNYC News, and she's been following Jared Kushner's business dealings for months. She's also co-host of the new podcast, Trump, Inc., from WNYC and ProPublica. Andrea, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, let's start with some basics about Jared Kushner. He's senior advisor to the president, and he's kind of famous now for having a really broad, kind of wide-ranging portfolio. But a big part of this story is that Jared Kushner is all over the world. He's meeting with leaders, having lots of different conversations in lots of different countries. What's his job? What is Jared Kushner doing when he's meeting with all these people around the world?
Well, as we heard, one of his main assignments is brokering Mideast peace. He was also put in charge of relationships with China and with Mexico. He is head of the White House effort on innovation and has presided over many meetings on infrastructure, or at least did when before all of the White House business councils disbanded in the wake of the Charlottesville fracas. And he also is working on prison reform. So kind of like his business empire, his White House empire is sprawling around the world and very varied.
So the president says a couple of small, easy deals aside from Mideast peace, but you're making the point that it's sprawling and broad. It's China, it's Mexico, prison policy, a lot of other things. Look, there have been concerns about public of interest, Andrea, ever since the election. Both the Trump Organization and the Kushner families, they both do business all over the world. And now they're doing diplomacy. They're negotiating trade. They're making deals on behalf of the United States. There have been a couple of business deals lately that have come under close scrutiny this week with Jared Kushner. What are they?
Well, it's quite a stunning number. So early in the week, the Washington Post reported that four foreign powers had been captured in some kind of intelligence intercepts, indicating that they wanted to influence the U.S. through Jared Kushner's business vulnerabilities. Now, there's no evidence that that happened, but this set off alarm bells even at the White House because there was anxiety about Jared Kushner going on meetings with foreign officials and not bringing in the standard briefing teams. So there was that story in the Washington Post, and then there was a story in the New York Times in which the New York Times reported that Jared Kushner, in his capacity at the White House, had met with executives of two lending companies, Apollo Global Management and Citigroup, and that he had met with them, Jared Kushner said, in his official capacity working on these issues, infrastructure, etc. But after the meetings, their lending arms had made a total of $500 million in loans to the Kushner companies. Now, Jared Kushner's lawyer spokesman and the Kushner companies both separately say, look, these were completely separate business transactions. Jared Kushner was working in his role as White House advisor, and these other things happened with the Kushner companies. And by the way, they were smart loans, well-backed. The buildings that they backed are valuable properties. The one is a skyscraper in Chicago. One is a sort of live-workspace complex in Dumbo in Brooklyn. But in the case of the Chicago skyscraper and Apollo, we do know that the loan they gave the Kushner companies was three times their average real estate loan size.
So, Andrea, we can't put a pin on conflict of interest necessarily, but in these ethical questions with business and policy mixed together, we talk about the appearance of conflict of interest, because that can undermine American interests as well. And there are other issues with Saudi Arabia. Jared Kushner negotiated a huge $110 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia in May. The Saudis also announced a $20 billion investment in Blackstone Group with ties to the Kushner family. Early in the administration, it was reported that Jared Kushner's sister told a group of Chinese investors when she was over there talking business that they might have access to hard-to-get visas to move to the United States.
The example of his sister, Nicole, in China, is probably the most direct example that we know of the Kushner companies using their White House ties to try to sell something. There were some reporters there. They saw it happened. The Kushner family later apologized and withdrew from this Chinese visa program. But the issue of conflict of interest, and in our Trump Inc. podcast, we have been looking at this broadly, because what all of the experts that we speak to say is it's not a matter of a particular business transaction getting mixed up with a particular public policy transaction. It is the inability to untangle people's impressions of these vast business empires. And there are three of them just within the Trump family at the White House. There's, of course, Donald Trump's vast business empire, and he declared that he has a no-conflict situation, so he still maintains ownership. But then following that, his daughter Ivanka and his son-in-law Jared Kushner also came in with their business empires worth at least many hundreds of millions of dollars, and also did not completely sever financial ties, although they all said we're not working on the day-to-day. But the problem that the ethics people tell us is there's just no way of knowing how any of these transactions come out. Or in the case that we were talking about the foreign intelligence, well, these foreign countries apparently think that these are levers. Maybe some business people think that doing a favor for the Kushner company, or not even doing a favor, just doing a deal, is somehow going to help them in their public interests. And that is the sort of fundamental contradiction of the Trump administration, is there's no way to sort out the motives of all of the people involved. And really, our systems of ethics and our Constitution did not foresee someone like Donald Trump and Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump being in the White House, because the laws are not really written to have the kind of clarity between what is happening in the public interest and what might be happening in the private interest. The laws just aren't written to account for this size of business empire.
Right. So, Andrea, it seems to me there are two major areas, to keep it simple, that we can look at here talking about conflict of interest. One, we're already talking about, is Jared Kushner self-dealing on America's dime? We don't know. There's appearance of conflict of interest. That's a problem. Getting loans while discussing official business, for example. The other, though, is whether he's too conflicted to do his job in national security. Jared Kushner lost his top secret security clearance, it was reported last week. Is that directly related to the type of business entanglements and the governments around the world who think they might have levers with him? Are those things related?
Well, maybe. One of the things we know is that his empire is so complex. I mean, it involves skyscrapers on Fifth Avenue at one of the most prestigious addresses in New York City, right next to Rockefeller Center, just a couple blocks from Trump Tower. So that's part of his real estate empire. His real estate empire includes the former New York Times building on Times Square. It also includes low-income apartments in Maryland and Ohio and Pennsylvania. So, and each of these empires has LLCs set up, limited liability corporations or shell companies, which could have hundreds of members. And we just don't know who is in those business empires. So one of the concerns that intelligence officials articulated in the Washington Post story was that foreign companies think that these vast, complicated business deals, and in the case of the Fifth Avenue skyscraper, the Kushner company has a deadline of paying off a $1.2 billion loan within the next year, and they haven't, that we know, raised money. So there is all of this potential that foreign governments could think that they could exploit these business needs of the Kushner companies to somehow advance their own interests.
Well, we don't know why Jared Kushner can't get a top secret clearance. The White House won't discuss it, but it's evident that people in the national security apparatus who are in charge of reviewing these things and granting authorization for these clearances think that Jared Kushner shouldn't have one. And then the question becomes, once you've talked about all the business ties, Andrea, how can he do his job without access to top secret information? You know, can he broker Middle East peace? Can he talk about Egypt and Saudi Arabia, for starters, China for that matter, without top secret clearance?
Well, the Kushner family, as our partners at ProPublica have reported, has donated to settlements on the West Bank. And his family is very close to the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, who has been to the Kushner family home in New Jersey. So even assuming that Kushner was on neutral territory and could do it, I think the answer is he works for the president. So whatever the president wants, he can do. I mean, I also think it's worth pointing out that the Trump White House, and particularly the president, has been at war with the national security apparatus in some way since even before he became president. So I think it's just important to view these stories in that context of there is a lot going on in Washington and that back and forth.
And Andrea, before we go, because I have a feeling that you and I are going to be talking about this again, is Robert Mueller looking at all of this? Is if he's looking at business dealings and official acts, could Jared Kushner potentially be in some trouble?
Well, we do know that in the Flynn guilty plea, he said that he had been in touch with a very senior campaign official who's been identified as Jared Kushner in discussions during the transition over being in touch with the UN about a vote about Israel sanctions. And we don't know where Mueller's going with that. So that is a big question of his investigation. And then the other thing that's been looked at is Jared Kushner's meeting with a Russian banker during the transition. So Kushner says that there are explanations for all of these things. We just have to wait and see what Mueller finds.
And not just a Russian bank, but a Russian bank that was under U.S. sanctions at the time. Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for politics and policy at WNYC. Download her podcast, Trump Inc., from WNYC and ProPublica. Get a lot more of this type of coverage of the Trump and Kushner business empires. Andrea, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ben Carson had experience as a renowned surgeon and an author and a public speaker when he was appointed by President Trump to be the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. What he didn't have was any experience in housing policy or governing. The appointment was a surprise to a lot of people, including, by most reports, Ben Carson himself. Here he is speaking to HUD employees back in March of 2017.
One of the first jobs that I want to do as Secretary is listen. Just listen to people across this country. We're going to go on a listening tour. We're going to see what works and what doesn't work.
Secretary Carson did all of that listening. He visited public housing projects and subsidized apartments all around the country. And ever since, the world hasn't heard much from Secretary Ben Carson until reports this week that his office spent $31,000 on a custom-made dining set for his HUD office. And a report from a whistleblower that Carson's wife, Candy, pushed an employee to circumvent congressional approval rules for that purchase. All of this has put a lot of unwelcome attention on Ben Carson, including from congressional oversight investigators, and it's also caused us to ask, what policies is Ben Carson pursuing from his office at HUD, and what's the impact on the rental support and assistance it gives to 4.5 million American households? Vincent Reyna is assistant professor for city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania and a former HUD employee from 2002 until 2004. Professor Reyna, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so for the price of $31,000, the spotlight is on HUD. What's been Ben Carson's mission in his first year? What has he done?
It's really hard to discern what the direct mission is, but one thing that's been clear is that the policy signals have moved towards this notion of programs, or at least rhetoric around self-sufficiency, right? And another key tenet is movement away from some of the key Obama administration successes and trying to push those or defer those at least down the road, which can easily be argued as a way of essentially dismantling those policies.
The Trump administration proposed close to $7 billion in annual cuts for HUD. Does Secretary Carson support those cuts? How has he been managing the agency with that proposal in front of Congress?
You know, that's really hard to say. There's actually, like you said, there's been a lot of silence over the past year. You know, we've seen a lot of budget proposals come out, but quite honestly, you know, the general statements from HUD about what's in the proposals, but less about specifics and direction of some of this stuff.
Well, Vincent, we've been following some specific areas of housing policy on this program over the last couple of months. The Trump administration, through HUD, delayed the small area fair market rent rule. This was in place so that people receiving rental assistance can calculate average rent by zip code instead of by metropolitan area. And the point here was basically to break through on economic and racial segregation, to make it so that neighborhoods are more mixed. What's going on?
Basically, the challenge here is that there's been a big push to say a zip code shouldn't determine your future. And there's a lot of evidence that neighborhoods actually matter to people's household outcomes, right? And so this policy was an effort to try to allow households to access these quote unquote higher opportunity neighborhoods and allowing the voucher rent limits to actually pay rents that would allow someone to actually move to those neighborhoods and afford a rent. So what this recent administration has done is try to defer that program till later on under the premise that we need further research that shows the impact of this program. Interestingly, there was a recent court case in Washington, D.C. that essentially said that HUD actually has to move forward with rolling out this program. So current signals suggest that this program will move forward, but the reaction from the administration to this program and the premise on which that reaction is based is an important signal about kind of priorities and where they see this program going forward.
Ben Carson is known for being a champion of self-sufficiency, certainly small government, a real conservative. He's written about all of these things. Can you discern any strategy, any direction? Are these preferences being reflected through HUD policy now, as far as you can tell?
I mean, they are, insofar as in press releases about the budget and about the current Envision program that they're trying to roll out, there are discussions of self-sufficiency. The challenge here is that the notion of self-sufficiency, particularly in the application here, is a very loaded concept. And it also implies a certain essentially normative judgment about the households in these properties that don't really match the facts. You know, only 10% of people across all of HUD programs right now have welfare as their major source of income. 40% are 62 or older. A fair number of these households have a head of household who's disabled. So, you know, these kind of rhetoric around self-sufficiency is problematic on multiple fronts, not the least of which is there's a profile of HUD tenants that some of these programs that they might create around those concepts don't necessarily match their needs. So one example is these Envision Centers, which actually is a very small line item in the greater scheme of the HUD budget proposal. And it's this idea of creating these centers near public housing to essentially help people access additional information, provide resources. There's a lot of other components to it. So the idea of providing more information and access to resources to low-resource communities is a phenomenal idea, right? But when it's couched under this notion of self-sufficiency, it becomes more problematic. It's even more problematic when you consider that the funding for public housing and many other programs are actually being cut.
Well, Vincent Reyna, let's end where we began. I think it's fair to say that America doesn't pay as much attention to housing policy for low-income people as it does to scandals or the Russia investigation or fights between high-profile officials. For the price of $31,000 for a dining set, you think it's worth it that we're talking about housing policy now, to the extent that we are?
I want to end on two thoughts. First of all, there's a general challenge in housing policy of people thinking that it's a choice, right? When evidence shows there's only 35 affordable and available units for every extremely low-income household, there is a serious supply gap here, which creates a demand for support around subsidized and affordable housing. That said, if you want to talk specifically about the recent controversies, the average rental assistance for a household across all HUD programs is $725 per month. So that equals 42 months of rental assistance or 3.5 years of rental assistance for essentially one dining set, right? So, you know, when we think of these things, it's not about funding for purchases for furniture and et cetera. It's about the disconnect between a sincere need for and the distinct need for affordable housing that's well documented, and the fact that, you know, these small sums of money at $31,000 actually mean a whole lot for a lot of the lowest income households in the U.S. And we need to think critically about that, because this isn't a choice. This is actually a function of a lot of other systemic barriers.
Vincent Reyna, Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've been spending some time in Oakland, California this week, and let's go back there now.
Shut down ICE! Yeah. Shut down ICE! Shut down ICE! Shut down ICE!
A public statement from Mayor Libby Schaff touched off a major confrontation with federal immigration officials on Saturday.
Yesterday, I learned information from multiple sources that there is potentially an ICE activity planned in the Bay Area that could be starting as soon as today. My priority is to keep this community safe.
Mayor Schaff was right. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested more than 150 people in sweeps throughout Northern and Central California. The arrests led to protests in San Francisco. Meanwhile, ICE officials have been lashing out at Mayor Schaff for tipping off who they say are hundreds of criminal undocumented immigrants. Tyke Hendricks is immigration and criminal justice editor for KQED in San Francisco, and I asked Tyke about the sweeps and the reaction to the mayor's warning.
Her actions drew a swift and angry reaction from the acting director of ICE, Thomas Homan. We can hear him right here on Fox News talking about it.
What she did is no better than a gang lookout yelling police. I mean, it's beyond the pale. I've been doing this for 34 years, and this is a whole new low to intentionally warn criminals that law enforcement's coming.
Did ICE see this coming?
I think Mayor Schaff took it to a new level with this announcement that she made, and there's been this really tense back and forth over the last number of days, where she's saying, look, I represent these immigrant communities and we don't want fear in our communities. A lot of these people are otherwise law-abiding people. And Homan's really emphasizing the folks who have criminal histories, who are part of the people who are being picked up. But here's a response from Schaff as far as why she feels justified in what she did.
My warning was general in nature. It did not come through official channels. It did not have specific locations. So it certainly was not the type of warning that may have put anyone in extra danger.
And so the mayor of Oakland sounded the alarm about these ICE raids coming to the area. What has that enforcement actually looked like?
ICE said that about half the people they picked up in Northern California this week have criminal convictions in addition to their immigration violations. And that means that the other half do not. We've had sanctuary cities in a lot of parts of the Bay Area. And just in the last year or so, California made itself a sanctuary state. And what that means is not that ICE can't operate in these places, but that the law enforcement locally will limit cooperation with ICE. Not in every case. There are a lot of exceptions for people who have serious criminal histories. But this has led to a situation where sheriff's deputies and jails are not allowing ICE in to screen, you know, who's been arrested. And so the response from ICE Director Homan is to say, if you won't let us take custody of people in the jails, then we have no choice but to make more arrests out in the community.
This confrontation isn't new, but it seems like over the last week, certainly the rhetoric has ramped up, even as the head of ICE gets on Fox News to attack the mayor of Oakland.
Yeah, I mean, the gloves are off. And I think this has been the case. You know, it's not just Mayor Schaff. California is a state where, you know, more than one in four people was born in another country. That means there are a lot of people who are the children of immigrants. It means that even the 2 million or so unauthorized immigrants are, you know, in our schools, in our workplaces. So it's sort of hard to say like there's something other over there. And the state legislature has, as I said, made this a sanctuary state. And there are other things like allowing undocumented people to get driver's licenses or to get in-state tuition and financial aid for college. But as you say, it is definitely coming to a head. You know, it's hard to know quite where that's going to go.
Tyke Hendricks, immigration and criminal justice editor for KQED in San Francisco. Tyke, great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Some ICE detention proceedings begin with dramatic raids at places like farms or restaurants, but others begin a lot more quietly when immigrants least expect they might get picked up. Michael Pukri is 21 years old. He lives in New Jersey, and he's a DACA recipient from Albania. His father and mother were taken into ICE custody when they thought they were going in for a green card.
This diversity visa, in my opinion, was a complete setup. Just because from the very beginning, if we were not eligible, they wouldn't have let us continue on the steps. We did every single step. We signed every paper, sent in everything. Everything came back accepted, perfect, from the first step to the last step.
We'll hear more about this experience and much more from Michael and his family on Monday's program. But how do deportation proceedings begin now under the Trump administration? And what kinds of tactics are ICE agents using to seek out and pick up non-citizens? Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department. He was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, welcome back.
Thank you.
Leon, are we seeing new methods in arresting or detaining undocumented immigrants now? What kind of tactics are we seeing?
What we're really seeing is a return of tactics that had been used in 2007 and 2008 under the Bush administration, as ICE feels more and more frustrated that they can't go into local jails and pick people up. They are trying to figure out ways to get people to voluntarily turn themselves in, albeit through subterfuge, rather than having to do the kinds of operations that require them to bang on doors and cause mayhem and havoc in an apartment building. But it's also difficult from the standpoint of making affirmative misrepresentations to get people to voluntarily put themselves into ICE custody. So it's really a no-win situation there.
So the Pukri family thought they were going in for a green card. We've heard from others on this program who thought they were going in for regular immigration check-ins with authorities, only to walk in the office and be arrested. These are the types of tactics you're talking about.
Yes, Todd. The situation with the check-ins is one where under the Obama administration, the purpose for those check-ins was in order to keep tabs on people that had been given grants of prosecutorial discretion, meaning that ICE said, we know we can remove you, but we're not going to remove you because you have such compelling ties to the United States. Under this administration, it's saying, well, very few people are going to be entitled to that prosecutorial discretion. So most people that come in are actually going to be apprehended and returned into the removal process. The problem is it's really a no-win situation either way. If you don't go to the check-in, then your removal case is foreclosed, basically. At that point, you've given up any rights that you have. But having said that, if you do show up, you're now subject to this detention and potential removal. So you're really in this no-win situation.
And you mentioned before we go, Leon, that ICE agents have more difficulty in some places simply going to the jails to pick people up. This would evoke the controversy of sanctuary cities or sanctuary states where local law enforcement isn't cooperating. And so now maybe ICE turns around and says, we resort to these tactics because we can't do it the old easy way.
Correct. That's the preference of ICE, is to not have to do any sort of affirmative work into get people into detention. They would rather much sit there in the local jails and basically collect people as they're being released. To the extent that jurisdictions don't cooperate with that view of the world, first of all, you know, people have good reasons not to, but putting that aside, to the extent that that doesn't happen, ICE then says, well, what do you want us to do? That same person that we could have taken voluntarily at the jail, we now have to find them somewhere. And so this is what creates these other can't-win scenarios where you have to either now start barging doors and creating havoc or using this subterfuge. And so this is a set of can't-win choices all throughout. And, you know, these are the problems when you start engaging in significant immigration enforcement, and you have to determine whether the populations you're engaging in are populations that it makes sense to be engaging in this kind of enforcement against, or whether you're doing it against really sympathetic people.
Leon Fresco, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice. Leon, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
classic movie music, from the moon to Earth orbit, all the way to Jupiter, and a tear in time itself. 2001, Space Odyssey, 1968, one of the great movie scores in film history. Did it win the Oscar? Nope, not even nominated. In fact, technically not a score at all, I'm told. That's Richard Strauss there, an old-time classical composer. That means he can't win original score for the Oscars. Oliver won best score that year, 1969, if you can believe it. But let's stop living in the past, because the 90th Annual Academy Awards are this Sunday, and let's talk about music. We'll get to the Best Picture nominees at the end of the hour, but first, some of the music behind the major nominees and some of the songs and scores in this year's musical categories. Melissa Locker is culture reporter for us here at The Takeaway.
I am so excited about the Oscars this year. I will admit I'm behind a little bit on some of my movie watching, but I am 100% up on all the scores and all of the songs, because those are kind of my favorite parts of the movies.
The scores and the songs don't get a huge feature in the Oscar broadcast, so I'm glad we're doing this because it can kind of fly by you. You've got Johnny Greenwood, who's a member of Radiohead. He scored Phantom Thread, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, also scored There Will Be Blood, one of my favorite films.
Yeah, so Johnny Greenwood, it's pretty exciting for him. This is the first time he's been nominated for an Oscar. He obviously has plenty of Radiohead accolades, but he's done four film scores with Paul Thomas Anderson, and this is the first time he's been nominated for an Oscar. Unfortunately, he's up against some pretty stiff competition. It's basically Clash of the Titans playing out in the original score category, because you have Johnny Greenwood going up against Alexander Desplat, who has won multiple awards in the past, including for The Grand Budapest Hotel. He's up for The Shape of Water. He's also up against John Williams, who is, you know, Star Wars legend.
I was about to point out that Alexandre Desplat has 9 Oscar nominations, until I was told that John Williams has 51.
Right? I mean, Johnny Greenwood is kind of like a fan favorite because he has done some incredible work. But how do you go up against somebody who has 51 Oscar nominations?
Those are some of the nominees for Best Score, Melissa. Best Song is completely different.
Yeah, so on Best Original Song, they're kind of unique songs that are written specifically for movies. And some of them go on to be like mega hits. Like This Is Me from The Greatest Showman is already a chart topper in countries around the world. But take a listen to this one.
Oh, to see without my eyes, the first time that you kissed me, boundless by the time I cried. I built your walls around me.
Why? So a lot of people are calling Sufjan Stevens this year's Elliott Smith.
And this one, Melissa, is Mystery of Love. This is from Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, and I think it's such a beautiful, evocative song that really works perfectly with the movie. But there are a lot of other competitors. For example, this one from Mary J. Blige.
Life is a teacher, time is a healer, and I'm a believer, like a river wild. Ego's a killer, greed is a monster, but love is stronger, stronger than them all.
This is remarkable, Melissa. Mary J. Blige is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Mudbound. She has a nominee for Mighty River that we're listening to, but she's never been nominated for an Oscar before.
I know, and look at her go. She's nominated for 2 awards, and it really her first effort at this, which is incredible. But it's Mary J. Blige, so you kind of had to expect it.
Melissa, you've got a song, Remember Me, from Coco. I gotta say, I loved this movie. I like the song, too. Coco was just one of the year's best movies for me, even though it was sort of an animated special.
Remember me, though I have to say goodbye. Remember me, don't let it make you cry. For even if I'm far away.
These composers, Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, were involved in Frozen. Kids love Frozen.
I mean, whether you want to blame them for this or thank them for this, they did write Let It Go. And I'm sorry if that song just got stuck in your head. But perhaps listen to Remember Me, it will slowly disappear. And I have to say, like, this backstory behind this song is really sweet, too, because Robert Lopez's mother passed away, and this song kind of helped them process their grieving, and working on this film helped them process their grief. And I think it's just a beautiful story about, you know, a family. My son and I went and saw this movie, and we somehow had the theater to ourselves, and we are both crying our eyes out the entire time.
Well, Melissa, talking about the Oscars is always about predictions, so best song, what's your pick?
Well, I think the winner's probably going to be This Is Me from The Greatest Showman, but who I think should win is Remember Me from Coco.
Well, we will see if they pick your pick, and people now are armed with all of the musical information that they need for Sunday for the Oscars. For Best Score and Best Song, Melissa Locker, culture reporter for us here at The Takeaway. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Todd.
Yo contigo siempre voy. Remember me.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on two legs, right?
Why are you telling me this?
The man who commissioned this study, he's one of about a dozen party guests out on your patio.
I'm not protecting any of them. I'm protecting the paper.
Because I wanted you to know.
In life, what is your purpose?
Don't pick a fight with me. You certainly won't come out alive.
You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
Because I wanted you to know.
Right now, he's finding those keys.
Oscar winners movie montage. That's what that sounds like. It's fun to guess when they do these. I think those are Oscar winners. I have a feeling I'm right. The Oscars are on Sunday for 2018. It's an unpredictable year at the Oscar. There's a lot of wins that could make history this year. Rachel Morrison is the first woman nominated for a cinematography award for the film Mudbound. Also, Jordan Peele, he's the director of Get Out, and he has a shot at becoming the first African-American to win for Best Director or for Original Screenplay. He's nominated for both. There are 9 films in the Best Picture category this year. It's huge, ranging from historical dramas, you have Darkest Hour and Dunkirk, both with the Winston Churchill theme, fantasies like Shape of Water, and a lot of different kinds of films in between. Allison Wilmore is here, film critic for BuzzFeed, sharing the mic with Rafer Guzman, our regular film critic, of course, from Newsday. They're both here with their picks for Best Picture. Guys, welcome.
Hi.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you both. I want to go through some of your best picks for Oscar nominations, Best Picture. Hey, guys, feel free to jump in on one another. You know, Allison, Rafer's not used to having any competition.
Got to share the spotlight today.
Yeah, no, he is. Get in there. Allison, you get first go deferential treatment for a new film critic here on The Takeaway. Talk about some of your top picks.
Well, if I could pick one film that I would like to see win Best Picture this year, it would be Get Out, I think. It feels like the film of the year, you know, for so many reasons, as a cultural breakthrough, as just a great film, and as something that really, I think, is evidence that the Oscars are moving past a very traditional idea, this kind of stodgy old idea of what a, you know, capital I important film is, because I think this film feels very important.
Yeah, I would agree. I wish I could disagree with you, Allison, on that one, but no, I mean, Get Out was my number one in my top 10. It's really the one film that felt very right here, right now to me. I love Dunkirk, probably the best directed film this year.
Sure.
Amazing sound, incredible
huge
visuals.
Huge sweep, yeah.
I mean, terrific. But, I mean, does it really speak to you emotionally? And does it really speak to you now in 2018? Not really. But Get Out really does.
Yeah. I have a real personal soft spot for Phantom Thread, which I think is just like a beautifully made, surprising film, this kind of perverse romantic comedy that you don't really realize is a romantic comedy till the end. But I'm happy to just see it kind of get a nomination, frankly.
Swan Song for Daniel Day-Lewis, though, it just makes me sad even seeing the trailers.
Oh, but he's so great in it, though.
Really his swan song?
I know.
Though? Is it really?
A lot of people have been prone to retiring dramatically and then kind of quietly making their way back. So we'll see.
Rafer, you say that Shape of Water was among the top for you this year.
It definitely was, and I think it's probably going to be the one to win. I do think the copyright infringement lawsuit that's come out about it has been pretty interesting and not totally easy to ignore, I think. But I still did love the film. I thought it was just gripping, amazing looking, very different. I think one reason it'll win is because it's kind of a movie lover's movie. It sort of turns all the old tropes on their heads, but it also pays homage to them at the same time. I thought it worked really well on that front. Yeah. Also, Todd, you were just talking about scores. I think it's going to win for score as well.
It feels like this year's La La Land, not that everything lines up easily, but it is the film that kind of makes gestures towards classic Hollywood,
right.
And it feels this very kind of grand in an old-fashioned way.
You mentioned copyright infringement. Is somebody alleging that the script has been cribbed? What's up?
Yes, the son of Paul Zindel, the author that you guys might remember from My Darling, My Hamburger and Man in the Moon Marigolds,
yeah.
The play. Playwright, novelist, wrote a play back in, I think it was 69, called Let Me Hear You Whisper, that also involves a cleaning woman at a government facility who falls in love with an aquatic creature who's being experimented on and helps him escape. Not totally out of the question.
I think it was a dolphin in this case.
It was a dolphin.
Not a
that's
merman. Yeah,
fair enough.
But,
it was a dolphin. So there are differences, but I think this is one of those. And, you know, you get a lot of these issues every so often where someone comes up and says, hey, that's my movie. You know, there's a guy right now who's trying to take credit for The Room.
Yes.
Of all things. But, you know, so you get these things. But this one does sound like you can't immediately poo-poo it, I would say.
Yeah. I wanted to also mention in here Lady Bird, of course, which I kind of have a gut feeling could pull off a surprise
win. A total possibility.
I could see it. It's a movie that everyone really seems to like. You know, Greta Gerwig, also a fifth woman to ever be nominated for Best Director. And I think she just made a really, like, nice, kind of warm, comforting feeling film that also has some sharp edges. But, you know, I think in this year, there's a lot of appeal to that.
And some phenomenal performances in Lady Bird as well. You guys want to hit on Three Billboards. It generated some controversy, but also phenomenal performance from Frances McDormand, which is pretty much what you'd expect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I did like this movie. Again, the acting, I think, is what carries it. You know, McDormand, Sam Rockwell, who I think are both going to win. Woody Harrelson probably won't win, but he's fantastic. I do feel a little bit like it's this year's Crash. It's it's really well-made, nice writing, seems profound, isn't, actually. But right. People like it a lot, and
yeah.
It has really resonated with people. I think what's interesting is when I talk to critics, they all say, oh, Shape of Water, Shape of Water. When I talk to my dad says, I love Three Billboards. I think, like, that movie just, like, resonated with people for some reason.
Yeah, it feels big, you know, and I think that there are ways in which maybe for people, it speaks a bit to the Me Too moment. There's
yep.
this kind of, like, very potent female rage to it.
Yep.
And at the same time, though, I think a lot of people have felt, including myself, that it's pretty flippant when it comes to race, in particular
yes.
racialized police violence, which is just kind of a backdrop element that it never really engages with.
Some honorable mentions. Well, not honorable mentions yet because they are nominated. A Call Me By Your Name starring Armie Hammer. The Post with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. The story of the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers, even though that was a New York Times story back then.
Yes.
Let's talk real quick before we go Darkest Hour. I don't know if it's a contender to really win. Is there a potential for a Best Actor win here?
Yeah, Gary Oldman, I think, is the shoo-in for this. It is the most classic Oscar-y performance you could possibly have, you know, playing this historical figure, doing something that's kind of between acting and an impression sometimes,
yes.
and prosthetics and makeup. I think that it is maybe not the one that's being most talked about in terms of a breakout. Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name is beloved, but I think that he's probably going to be the one to win.
We're going to leave it there because I got to prepare for the Oscars. Look, my pick, I just said it, Get Out for Best Picture, definitely. I'm with you guys. Allison Wilmore with BuzzFeed, Rafer Guzman with us and Newsday. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. And the movie that I liked the most this year was Lady Bird because it showed the progression of a young woman who had doubted her faith, experienced trials in her life, and then returned to her faith as her touchstone.
I'm Shelley from Athens, Ohio. I absolutely loved The Greatest Showman, way more than I expected to. It was such a delight of color, song, dance, and characters. The movie is actually still playing in my small hometown theater, and last week when I attended, the audience members clapped at the end. After all the adoration for the musical La La Land, I find it interesting that Showman has not gotten more attention or was not nominated for more awards.
Well, tweet us your pick for Best Picture. It doesn't have to be nominated. We don't care. At The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the Oscars. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.